Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today I am here with the co-host, Russ Chianelli. And today we're going to be talking about something very sort of focused on the Southwest. What do we have in the Southwest? We have sunshine. What do we not have in the Southwest? We don't have water. And this is a sort of conundrum. I mean, I remember when I first came to America, I drove through and I went to a place called Yuma. And before I got there, I could smell orange groves and lemon groves. And I thought, what the hell are they doing here? Well, we're going to talk about those two things. The need for sun we have, the need for water, and what are the plans for a clever number of entrepreneurs and scientists and engineers to sort of bring some new life to the Southwest. And who better to understand that than Russ Chianelli? Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio a friend and colleague for many years, Glenn Schrader. He's at the University of Arizona, and he's the Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Education. Welcome to Science Studio, Glenn.
We're Thanks very much, Russ. It's always great to visit you here in El Paso. And every time I come here, I always think of how much we have in common. And I agree, you know, lots of sunshine, but just not enough water.
Okay. You mean so the regions.
Yes, I think that's the challenge, but also the opportunity.
Before we get on to the challenge, before we get on to the opportunity and the way entrepreneurs can make a little money, I'm sure it will come out of this, tell us a little bit about Glenn. How did you become an engineer, a scientist, chemical engineer? What were those moments when you were a young kid that sort of said, hey, this is a career for me?
You know, in many ways, I'm a product of the Sputnik generation. I grew up in the upper Midwest, where I think always education was extremely important.
The upper Midwest, is that Michigan?
Actually, the Dakotas, Minnesota, every place where it really gets so terribly cold that it would make you want to move to Arizona.
All right. Okay.
So that's why I'm probably now in Arizona. But, you know, although education was really important, there were always just sort of trigger events that made a difference. And I can remember as a kid the launching of Sputnik. You know, I was kind of young, but I can remember looking for that satellite. And I think I was also one of those kids that could remember every astronaut's name, both, you know, the American and Russian ones. I was really fascinated by that.
So. Yeah, I remember watching the first American satellites going up in the same period and say, ah, we got it.
Yeah. No, it was, you know, it was a really exciting time to think about becoming a scientist or an engineer.
And so that was as simple as that. Your parents have any input? Your teachers?
Well, definitely. I think, you know, my mother was a school teacher, but I think it was actually my father who had studied organic chemistry in college. And believe it or not, you know, we had a lot of books, but one of the favorite books of my sister and myself was his organic chemistry book.
You remember the author?
Yeah, right. You know, so we would, you know, instead of picking up, you know, Grimm's fairy tales, we would look at this organic chemistry book. And I think that's what started me. My sister became a chemist. I became a chemical engineer. And I'm not sure where that organic chemistry book is to this
day.
Well,
can you draw thallocyanine for us?
You know, probably. She might be a little better than I am. But no, I think that's really kind of how it started. We came really, what was this subject? This is really intriguing.
So you went to university in the Dakotas or
Minnesota? I went to Iowa State University, and then I went to graduate school in Madison, Wisconsin. And those were both really great experiences.
So when you finished this whole sort of journey, that you got your degrees, you've obviously done quite well, then you're looking to think, well, how do I apply this? What were those sort of processes, and where did you sort of land up?
So my first university position was at the University of Delaware. And, of course, it had a wonderful tradition in chemical engineering, but it had a second campus, and the second campus was always DuPont. I remember the chairman of the department, Art Metzner, who hired me, said, you know, you should go down and spend 1 day a week at DuPont. You'll get a lot of really good ideas. And he was right. And, in fact, even after I left Delaware, those relationships existed for another couple of decades. And, of course, this is while I also met Russ and all the other great people that were doing catalysis research and all of the oil companies, chemical companies. It was really, I think that really probably was the heyday of industrial catalysis.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you were very straightforward with it. You never spilled anything from DuPont to Exxon.
No, well, you know, you had to be careful about that because you guys were all good competitors. But, you know, I always told all my graduate students that we should do research that had applications that really made a difference in the real world. But on top of that, you know, half of the scientists and engineers were in industry. So why would you want to, you know, cut off half your audience if you were You know, we always did fundamental research too, but there was always some idea that we knew might end up in industry. And thank goodness we had colleagues like Russ and others that would encourage us to move in certain directions. You wouldn't always tell us why we should move in that direction, but we kind of got good hints.
You mean research should have applications?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we'll come back to that, because if you just concentrate on a very clear present goal and need, then you can waste a lot of time.
That's
all right?
Right.
And you will not make such great leaps forward in basic understanding. But we will come back to that. So anyway, right now, you're the Dean of Research and the Dean of Graduate Education.
In the College of Engineering, that's right.
And the College of Engineering at the University of Arizona in Tucson, one of my favorite cities. Usually in the winter, I must say that. But tell us, what does that role involve? Why that combination? Because quite often you see one person with research, another with education. You've got both hats.
And we've kind of been evolving the role, because we've been reorganizing a lot in the last 5 or 6 years or so. But what we're really trying to do is build the research capacity in the college and the university, but probably in a little bit different direction that we've been thinking about in previous years. I mean, we're definitely, you know, a big science research university. But I think what we're seeing also is the applications are becoming more important. I think, you know, we're even seeing this, you know, as we look at the federal research budget for fundamental research. We've got to figure out other things to do, too. And again, I guess this sort of comes out of my tradition of always wanting to work with industry on some practical problems. So we've added more activities in the graduate education aspect of the college. It goes back to talking about a little bit about the difference between a T-shaped engineer and an I-shaped engineer. And I know the organizations like the National Science Foundation are very aware of this now, too, is that perhaps, you know, over the last 30 years, we went to more of an I-shaped, where engineers and scientists were very deeply educated, but probably in narrower and narrower fields. And, you know, a lot of emphasis on really, you know, making sure that we were always, you know, world-class, cutting
edge. Protecting the ivory tower.
Yeah, a little bit that way. And that's still very, very important.
And that's the I or the T?
That's the I.
And explain to me, and therefore my audience, our audience.
Right. So the T is a little bit more, when I was a graduate student, and this is quite a while ago, Wisconsin was probably the number one or two rated chemical engineering graduate program. But I also had a very famous professor that told me, he said, you know, you should go over and take that business law class. Of course, he also said we should learn some other foreign languages. You know, his favorite was German. I wish it had been Spanish. But, you know, you wanted to be a little bit broader than just thinking that you were going
to do. So to rephrase that, if you're a chemical engineer, your right arm might be business and your left arm chemistry.
That's absolutely right. That's a perfect analogy. And
so that's the T or the I?
That's the T.
The T.
You're right, right.
I've got a T and an I. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
One is closed at both ends,
well,
and one,
you know,
is open.
Your eye shouldn't have a bar at the top and the bottom. It's just a straight I.
Oh, okay. And the T at the top just means you can branch in more than one direction.
And you got you. Right,
okay.
Yeah.
So you're both T men. All right, that's what, right? You both want to be teamed.
I think
you both want this sort of vertical structure of knowledge, and then you want to reach out and with your arms to be the T and something applicable as well as some fundamental.
And, you know, we're also, particularly in the water area, we think that for civil and chemical engineers that enter into that field, they should know something about public policy. Regulatory, state and local issues, you know, dealing with the public.
Communication.
And, you know, those skills are extremely important. It makes for a very busy graduate career, but, you know, these are important aspects now.
So what you're sort of trying to put in place at Arizona is graduate education for science and engineering, but that involves not just the traditional courses and the basic research, still a thesis, still a fundamental research.
Absolutely.
But there's a compulsory component for every student, or is this an option where they can sort of look out into the neighboring area or some other neighboring area and say, hey, we can make an impact here, and that's needed in order to get your degree?
We are starting to develop courses. Sometimes these are even at the master level courses where you have these options for interdisciplinary activities. I think many students have always kind of gotten this. And so, you know, we're encouraging students to do it now. There gets to be in a whole, as we know in academia, there gets to be a whole series of regulations you have to sort of overcome to formally require these things. But I think the smart students are seeing that the world has changed, that for the most effective jobs that you really want to go after nowadays, having this breadth is a real advantage. So I think I think the students have gotten this idea already.
So, and Harvard and MIT has made a big point doing this.
Of doing what?
What they call University Inc., the broad thing that we're just talking about.
Okay. So in your particular area, our particular area, because we share, as you say, the climactic, geologic, and weather patterns and the like, you're making a sort of a big focus upon the concept of what we have, which is sun, and that presumably leads into solar energy and all the rest of it, and what we don't have, which is good, clean drinking and farming water. And what we do have is a dwindling resource. So that's where you think Arizona and surrounding institutions and states can make an impact.
In fact, if you really look at the region that we're concentrating on, it is the arid Southwest. But it's really also more clearly everybody that's dependent on Colorado River water. And, of course, here in El Paso, you are too, indirectly through the Rio Grande River. That river is clearly over-allocated. As climate change has a big impact on the Southwest, you know, it looks like we're going to be the most impacted by this. There's now a 50-50 chance in the next 3 or 4 years of a water emergency being declared on the Colorado River. In 2010, we came within about 10 or 15 feet on Lake Powell of having that emergency. When that emergency is declared, the allocations may change, or we may go into the situation where actually, for example, Arizona and Nevada are very much have very small straws. So what we want to do is be out in advance of this potential crisis.
So you got 2 to 3 years to get your act together.
Well, that's what the odds are. I mean, you know, if you want to go to Las Vegas and play the odds, you're welcome to it. But I think, as engineers and scientists, we tend to want to be a little bit more systematic about this. But we can tell that the overall trend, you know, seems to be in this drier and drier.
There's another issue, and that is that we're becoming a new Middle East. Texas production is more than Russia right now.
Right.
And each well is drilled requires cleanup of something like 9 barrels of water for each barrel of oil.
It's incredible, this so-called produced water that comes along with shale gas or whatever. It's an incredible amount of material, and in some cases it's hazardous.
In some cases it's hazardous. We'll take a break at that stage while you ponder what that means. This is Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Kiennetti, Glenn Schrader from University of Arizona, the Dean of Graduate Education and Research.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. The whole process of itchiness is actually quite mysterious and not at all understood. And even though the subject seems light, it isn't.
Just think about how uncomfortable it is to get a mosquito bite, but having that itch go on with no relief. It's torturous and something millions of Americans with long-term itch endure.
Here's what we've known about the itch sensation. Neurons called TRPV1 cells detect itchy substances on the skin, but they also detect pain and heat, so scientists didn't know if the itch sensation was just a lower form of pain rather than a unique sensation of its own.
That's why developing a therapy around TRPV1 cells has been tricky, because scientists would have to be careful not to affect other sensations. Plus, we just didn't fully understand the whole process.
Now a new study has identified a molecule that is uniquely responsible for itch. Researchers did this by looking for something in the TRPV1 neuron that was itch-specific. They found it in a small group of these neurons that were producing a natriuretic polypeptide B, or NPPB.
NPPB is a hormone we've known the heart muscle to produce for regulating itself. So it was surprising to learn that TRPV1 also produced NPPB, and that the hormone was acting as a neurotransmitter to relay messages between neurons, in this case, the itch stimuli.
Researchers discovered this by genetically engineering mice that lacked NPPB. These mice did not itch when they were given itch-inducing compounds, proving that NPPB is required for mice to itch. The mice also didn't have other sensory deficits from the missing neurotransmitter.
This new information is essential to researchers trying to come up with a therapy to help people debilitated by chronic itch.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pennell, Russ Chianelli, Glenn Schrader, University of Arizona, Chemical Engineering, and the Dean of Graduate Education and Research. Glenn, you just finished off with a little comment, and sometimes it's hazardous. Just go into how hazardous is this fracturing, as from your vantage point.
Right.
You're an engineer.
Right. You know, I don't think we know the total environmental impact yet, you know, and of course the United States in some areas is going full steam ahead. In other areas, the amount of new licensing for fracking has been halted. Europe, some places, is pretty skeptical about this. I think the bigger issue actually for us, though, is that this water that comes along with fracking can actually be very useful water. And one of the themes that we're working here with UTEP on is actually using some of this water, and sometimes it's referred to even as brackish water, as a new source of drinking water or water for industry. So I think the overall strategy is trying to figure out how we're going to be able to do fracking.
Or fertilizing farms.
Yes, right, and agriculture production. So we know some of these water reserves can be very useful. It depends on how we decide to use them.
So your thesis here then is that, as far as I know it, it's something like a million barrels is needed of water, or a million gallons, I'm sorry, you know, in order to fracture the subterranean shale region, right? And that's the water that you get back. It comes back, you know, you pump it down, and then it comes back up. And as you say, it's full of all sorts of things, and it's not totally clear that we know everything about what's there. Is this the water you're talking about? Or are you talking about some other?
Well, there's another source. There are other sources of water too. Some of these are referred to as brackish waters, and of course, here at UTEP and with the K. Bailey Hutchinson plant here in El Paso, you've been leaders in looking at brackish water and using it in the fresh water supply.
So, but that's a separate issue.
That is
from
a
the
separate
fracking issue.
That's a separate
fracking issue is you put water down,
right.
You get it back, and it's dirty. And you've got to do something with it.
And there can be additional water that comes along also with it.
I don't know.
Some fracking operations produce relatively little so-called produced water. Mm-hmm. Others, as Russ is saying here, can produce 10 times.
It's sort of like going into the source with the oil and water together and getting more of both out.
That's absolutely right.
I mean, I didn't know this, Russ. Where are they producing water along with the gas?
Well, if you look at the map of Texas and some of the areas that are doing this right now, I would have to have the map out to show you, but I think one of the places in northeastern Texas, I forget the name of it.
Okay, but I mean, this is not just an idea. This is a reality.
Oh, yeah.
That opening up the gas is also
opening
up water.
The industry has been doing fracking for, you know, 20 or 30 years without a problem. I mean, it's not a new process. It's just one that's attacking some of these areas which were not produced before.
Right.
And the horizontal drilling. I mean, just the whole technology of what they're able to do.
I wanted you to talk a little bit about OASIS.
Yes.
Okay,
right.
Which is a project to get the universities together to work on these issues.
So OASIS is actually a project that we've been discussing with universities probably for the last couple of years or so. We're right now in the middle of writing a very big proposal on this activity that will actually be a public-private partnership between the federal, state agencies, the universities, but private industry too. And what we're really after is the next bucket of water for the Southwest. As I mentioned, the Colorado River is already over-allocated with climate change, decreased precipitation. Everybody has to find another source of water. There are very large reserves of brackish water in the Southwest, but they are not utilized because of their salinity content, and sometimes the salinity content varies, the composition varies considerably. So in many cases, also, you can't just design one process to do this. Well, as we all know, to produce drinking water or higher quality water that's used for industry or even agriculture, you have to use a lot of energy. So water and energy are coupled clearly in the Southwest, In fact, in Arizona, we move a lot of Colorado River water around the state of Arizona. We use 20% of our power in Arizona just to move the water around.
And how much of that water did you lose by evaporation?
That's considerable. Our largest user of water actually still in Arizona is agriculture.
Right.
And a lot of agriculture is still very inefficient in its use of water. Drip irrigation methods that are used and developed in Israel, for example, are much more efficient. So we have to look for not only new sources of water, but we also have to be more efficient at how we use the water.
And so that's all part of OASIS.
That's part of OASIS, but OASIS will really be going after these so-called brackish waters or impaired waters. We'll even be going after water that is produced as a result of mining operations. There are a lot of what are even called pit lakes throughout the Southwest. Many of these are below the hydrological water table, so the water seeps into these pits and simply evaporates.
One of the expressions I love that's in the proposal is, don't waste the waste.
That's right.
Can you talk about that
right,
a little bit?
Right. Well, we think there are a lot of wasted resources. And in fact, we regard these things as waste, but in many cases, they're just simply wasted. You could almost look at the heat and the energy that we have in the Southwest. You know, we know it's a resource, but a lot of times we complain that it's too hot. However, this could be the source of energy for actually purifying or and upgrading our water. So in many cases, energy is wasted. We know water is wasted. Many of these operations, you know, whether they're agriculture or industry, we could improve our efficiency. And also, you know, the other waste that's included is just simply materials.
Materials, some valuable metals and things like that.
Absolutely.
Tell me about the University of Arizona, right? I mean, this is it's a leading institution in North America, in the world. The degree to which the University of Arizona uses solar energy to run its operation.
We have three major research installations on the campus that produce solar energy. A couple of them are located at our tech parks. And in fact, we do have a demonstration facility that virtually provides most of the power for that tech park. We could do more. I always think that one of the really high-tech changes we could make about Tucson is if you flew into Tucson and you saw solar panels on every roof. That would be my objective. That if we could see that type of activity.
Well, you know, one of the things holding that up is storage at night.
That's right.
We have a lot of ideas about that, but I'd like to hear your comments.
Right. There's a lot of discussion now about storing solar energy through photovoltaics. Through either putting the energy on the electrical grid or through battery storage. The fact of the matter is those are also very inefficient processes. In many cases, actually, the grid right now in the Southwest is already saturated, and batteries yet to have the capacity and the efficiency to store the energy. So what we're really looking at now is our breakthroughs in solar thermal technology, where really huge amounts of energy can be stored in, for example, molten salts.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I think actually when you look at the efficiency of those processes, it's superior, vastly superior from this conversion to electrical power and then storing it on the grid.
That's interesting. I mean, I just remember reading an article last week where they wanted to use solar energy to pump water up.
Yes.
And then let it come down and generate electricity at night. And I thought, oh, that's cute.
That's actually also a very clever idea.
Well, it's a clever idea.
Yes, right.
And one of the things we worked on with NASA was, here's what you do. You have dirty water. You photoelectrolyze it. You store the hydrogen. You store the oxygen at night. You recombine it to get the electricity. And now you got clean water.
That's absolutely right. And this mechanism of chemical storage, that's really what you're talking about there, is very powerful. We know chemical fuels can store enormous amounts of energy. And again, you know, this type of advanced technology, I think, is a little bit more clever. And that's really what we're going after in this cooperative agreement between
the
universities.
Okay, so tell us exactly what OASIS is. Does it stand for anything, or is it just what it says?
Right. OASIS really stands for Organization of Sustainable Engineered Systems. So you can kind of get that acronym.
It's an E.
Yes,
okay.
Right. But, you know, the concept is, think of what an OASIS is. OASIS is a location that has a tremendous amount of sun. It's got some type of reliable water supply. It may be doing some agriculture. It may be even next to a sand dune where there's some other mineral resources. And so when we use that acronym for our collaboration, we're really thinking about sort of these independent, self-sustainable communities. And there could be manufacturing going on even on these too. But you have to manage the resources that you were wasting before. These resources shouldn't be wasted. They're not waste. They're just wasted. So that's the vision that we really have of an oasis.
Talk about the dimensional planes when you have a plan to go together,
right,
which just formalizes what you said.
Right. Well, to create such an oasis like this requires a lot of science and technology. When you do this at the federal government level with the National Science Foundation, as we're attempting to do, you have to have fundamental science, which Russ is referring to as kind of on the bottom plane. Then you have to have an enabling technology that you can demonstrate in real-world situations, in test beds. And then at the highest level, you have to put the whole system together. And that's the oasis: water, energy, materials, people. There's a very interesting component about this, too, because the oasis has to be livable. There has to be people who want to come and live in these types of sustainable communities.
Well, I mean, which brings up the point, then. Is this your vision? Do you have this as a big scheme, or do you just mention just now, but on a little micro scale, like each individual household is sort of reorganizing its thought process? We just put in solar panels on my house. I can afford to do it, and now I don't have any electricity bills except the tax. Is that the way you're thinking, to act in a society one little segment at a time, or you got a bigger vision?
So now I go back to my real engineering background, and
right,
a key function of engineering is always scalability. Can technology, science, the economic organization be scaled? And the scale in some cases may be small. In other cases, it may be big. In some cases, it may be a relatively remote location. You could think of a pit lake for a mining operation that is fairly remote. It may be completely off the grid,
even.
But on the other hand, it may be, for example, in Tucson, sectors of Tucson that band together to develop solar facilities, their own water supply, and their own recycling. So again, you know, this will probably only work if we can develop the capability to scale to different levels to fit really what the needs of the community are.
And then so that begins to be politics, because you've got to bring different sectors of your society into the big picture.
That's why we think, again, for graduate education, every engineer should know something about public policy. Should go back to the T-shaped engineer again. To really get new technology like this adopted, you really have to understand the communities and the situations that you're involved in. The environment.
Gotcha.
Are you aware that some of the students are in this, they have to build a zero energy use house as a contest? And it was funny, one of them was talking to me about it the other day, and they have to cook a dinner for two people and sleep there and do the whole thing.
Which just to remind me, years ago I took a bunch of students to the biosphere. Is that still functioning in any form?
Great question. In fact, we're launching a part of OASIS at the Biosphere in about a month. We're very happy that representatives from UTEP will be there and from the five-state region. We're not going to lock you into the Biosphere too. But it's a great setting, because this is kind of the idea many years ago of self-contained communities.
I think we've come to the end of a program, Glenn. I mean, this is such a big topic and such an ambitious project that we could come and revisit, you know, like on a regular basis. But this is a good beginning.
We look forward to the collaboration that this is going to build for all of us in the Southwest.
Glenn Schreyer, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio.
Please come back again. And I'd like to thank Norman Martinez, our producer.
And we obviously would like to thank the audience. Without you out there listening, we wouldn't do it. Tune in next week for another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Memorial Medical Center in Las Cruces has named John Harris as its new chief executive officer, effective November 1st. Harris is the former CEO of Sierra Providence Health Network in El Paso. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred Hospital, a transitional care hospital for extended stay patients.